Tehran marks the end for now of their 5,000-kilometer journey. It's been a year since they were released from the work camp in Altunay, 9 months since they finally left Verevskoye, Uzbekistan, where they'd been forced to spend the winter. January and February were tough on them. Subjected to a diet of 80 grams of bread and a bowl of watery soup a day, their midlines had been whittled away until they'd lost a quarter of their body weight. Were it not for the blankets Anders had issued, they'd have frozen to death. But they were lucky. Hundreds of others who'd come to Uzbekistan as they had to join the army were laid to rest in Verevskoye. Every week, a carriage would clatter through the village to collect the skeletal remains of those who had lost their battles with malaria, typhus, pneumonia, dysentery, starvation. The dead were gathered up with pitchforks and heaped into piles outside the city. When the piles rose too high, someone would smother the corpses in crude oil and burn them, causing a sickly smell that hung in the air long after the bodies had turned to ash. By March, it was clear that Stalin either wasn't able or wasn't willing to properly feed or equip the exiles who'd enlisted in Anders' army. There were 44,000 recruits, according to the registrar, awaiting orders in Uzbekistan. Rations issued by the Soviets, however, were maintained for 26,000. Furious, Anders pushed Stalin to allow him to evacuate his troops to Persia, where they would come under the care of the British. When Stalin finally agreed, Genek and Hertha set off on another four-month exodus, traversing 2,400 kilometers of endless steppe and desert through Samarkand and Chirakchi to the port of Krasnovodsk, Turkmenistan, on the eastern shore of the Caspian Sea. There, they were surrounded by NKVD toting large canvas bags. "Drop the belongings you can't carry," they were told, a rather pointless order, as most had nothing more to their names than the shirts on their backs. "Money and documents, too," the NKVD added. They'd be searched on embarkation, they were told. "Anyone trying to smuggle money or papers out of the country will be arrested." Genek and Hertha had used the last of their zloty months ago. Their Polish passports had been confiscated in Lvov. They said goodbye to their amnesty certificates and non-resident permits issued in Altunay, along with their foreign passports issued in Verevskoye. Without a single coin or form of identification in their pockets, they were true nomads. But it didn't matter. Whatever the requirements to get them out of the grip of the Iron Fist and into the caring hands of the British and General Anders, they were more than willing to oblige. It wasn't until they finally climbed the steep gangway to board the Gaganovich, the rusted-up freighter that would deliver them to the Persian port of Pahlavi, that they smelled their first hint of freedom in the hot, salty air. After a few days at sea, however, that smell was quickly overpowered by one of vomit, feces, and urine. For 48 hellish hours, they stood shoulder to shoulder with the thousands of other passengers on board, their shoes drenched in excrement, their scalps sizzling beneath the blaze of the relentless sun, their stomachs churned by the never-ending ocean swells. Every square centimeter of the ship was occupied, the hold, the deck, the staircases, even the lifeboats. Dozens died, their limp bodies held aloft by outstretched hands, passed overhead to the nearest opening on the vessel's railing to be tossed overboard, where they were swallowed by the sea. Genek and Hertha finally arrived in Pahlavi, a Persian port on the southern shore of the Caspian Sea, in August. Numbed by fatigue and dizzy with hunger, thirst, and seasickness, they learned that the last vessel to cross the Caspian, carrying with it over 1,000 souls, had sunk. They slept for 2 nights on the beach in Pahlavi under an open sky until a caravan of pickups arrived to take them to Tehran, where they were told a division of the Polish army awaited. A second sphere sails overhead, and this time, Genek reflexively catches it. Why would the locals taunt such a pitiful-looking group of people, he wonders. But when he opens his hand, he finds an orange. A nice one, too. Fresh. Plump. The first piece of fruit his fingers have touched in over 2 years. He glances over his shoulder to see if he can spot whoever threw it, catching the eye of a young woman wearing a maroon headscarf, standing on the sidewalk with her hands on the shoulders of two young boys in front of her. She smiles, her brown eyes soft and full of pity, and suddenly it's clear. The orange wasn't hurled as a sign of disrespect. It was a gift. Sustenance. Genek's eyes well up as he rolls the fruit between his palms. A gift. He waves at the Persian woman, who waves back and then disappears into a cloud of dust. Genek can't remember the last time a stranger did something nice for him without expecting something in return. He digs a dirty fingernail into the orange, peels it, and hands a wedge to Hertha. She bites off a piece and holds what's left of it to Yusef's lips, laughing softly as his nose crumples. It's an orange, Z, she offers, a new word for him. Pomarancha. Soon enough, you'll learn to like it. Genek peels off a wedge for himself and closes his eyes as he chews. The flavor explodes on his tongue. It's the sweetest thing he's ever tasted. Their camp faces north, overlooking the shore of the Caspian Sea, and beyond that, the purple-gray of the Elburz Mountains. Are we in heaven? Herta whispers as they approach, reaching for Genek's hand. Two young English women nod from beneath the brims of army caps and direct them toward a series of long, narrow tents with canvas flaps rolled and tied up to allow for airflow. Men to the right, women to the left, they explain, pointing at two tents marked sterilization. Inside the men's tent, Genek is more than willing to undress. He traded what clothes he could spare for firewood and extra food rations to help get through the Siberian winter. He's been wearing the same trousers, shirt, and undergarments nearly every day since. He makes his way, naked, to a hose spraying something that burns his nostrils as he approaches. You want to close your eyes, the recruit who is just finishing before him calls out. The sterilization shower stings, but Genek savors the cold bite of the solution cascading over his ribs, sloughing the grime from his skin, cleansing him of his time in exile. When it's over, he opens his eyes, relieved to see that his small pile of threadbare clothes has been removed, undoubtedly to be burned. He shakes a few drops of the sharp-smelling solution from his limbs and joins the other recruit at a bucket of what appears to be seawater, where he rinses off with a sponge. A sponge! With others waiting behind him, it's everything he can do not to revel for an extra minute or two in his first real bath in months. Smelling now like a mix of chlorine and the sea, he's handed a towel and guided to another tent. This one stocked with neat piles of new clothes, underwear, undershirts, and uniforms in several shapes and sizes. He selects a pair of lightweight khaki pants and pulls a collared short-sleeved shirt over his head, the cotton luxuriously soft against his chest. In a third tent, he's handed a pair of white canvas shoes, a cork helmet, a sack of dates, 6 cigarettes, and a small paycheck. Breakfast is at 7 o'clock sharp, he's told by the quartermaster as he turns to leave. Breakfast? He's so accustomed to living off of a single meal a day. The concept of putting something nourishing in his stomach at daybreak has become foreign. You know, bread, cheese, jam, tea. Cheese and jam and tea. Genek nods, salivating, too elated to speak. On the beach, he finds Hertha sitting with Yusef in her lap and a basket of oranges beside her. She's been issued the same khaki slacks and shirt in a women's cut. Yusef is naked but for a cloth diaper and a handkerchief that Herta has drenched with ocean water and draped over his head. He kicks his feet in the sand, fascinated by the feel of the tiny hot grains against his skin. A young Persian boy walks by selling grapes. They sit for a while in silence, staring at the horizon, at the shimmering surface of the Caspian Sea, and at the sawtooth line of the Elburz Range looming over it. "I think we've come to the right place," Genek says, smiling.
August 1942, Tehran. Soon after Anders's men reach Tehran, Stalin pushes hard to send the Poles directly to battle, but Anders insists that they need more time to recuperate. Many of his men die in Tehran, some too weak and sick from the exodus, some unable to stomach the sudden intake of rich food. Others, with the care of the Persians and the supplies sent from Britain, grow stronger. When new battle attire and real leather boots arrive in October, morale at the Tehran tent camp reaches an all-time high. August 23, 1942. The Battle of Stalingrad begins. Nazi Germany, supported by Axis forces, pushes the boundary of its European territories and fights for control of Stalingrad in southwestern Russia in what will become one of history's bloodiest battles.
Chapter 38. Felicia. Warsaw, German-occupied Poland, September 1942. Felicia sings quietly to herself, the song about the kitten that her grandfather taught her, as she squats on the kitchen's linoleum floor, balancing a nest of metal bowls one on top of another. She glances every few minutes at the round clock hanging by the stove. Her mother had taught her recently how to read time, counting down the minutes to 5 o'clock, when Mila is meant to arrive. The apartment belongs to a friend of her Aunt Halina's. It's much nicer than the flat in the ghetto. But at least in the ghetto, her mother came home to her every night. Here in Warsaw, for reasons Felicia still can't understand, her mother lives in a separate apartment down the street. They spend time together on the weekends, and once a week, Mila comes to the apartment to deliver money for the landlord. The couple that owns the place works, so Felicia has grown accustomed to spending her days alone. There's another stowaway, an old fellow called Carl, who arrived a few weeks ago. But she doesn't interact with him much. He mostly reads or stays in his room, which is fine with Felicia as it makes her uneasy when people she doesn't know, men especially, ask her questions. The lock on the apartment door rattles, and Felicia looks up at the clock, at the long hand. It's too early. Her mother is usually here just after 5, not before, and the owners of the place don't get home until 6. For a moment, she imagines it to be her father. "I found you," he'd say as he burst through the door, wearing his army uniform. But then she freezes, wonders if she should hide. She's been told to be careful about strangers. The apartment door opens and closes, and after a moment, a voice calls. Felicia softens when she recognizes it as her mother's cousin, Franca. "Felicia, honey, it's me, Franca. Your mother couldn't make it," she explains, as she makes her way from the foyer into the kitchen. "There you are," she says, finding Felicia sitting on the floor among her bowls. "Your mother is fine, just has to work late today." Franca sets a box on the kitchen table and bends to give Felicia a hug. "She has to work late?" Felicia asks, looking past Franca, as if willing her mother to appear. "She'll try to come visit you tomorrow," Franca stands. "Are you all right? Is everything okay here?" Felicia glances up at Franca. She seems nervous, like she's in a hurry. "I'm okay. Are you going to stay with me?" she asks, although she knows what the answer will be. "I wish I could, love, but I'm working this evening, and Sabine is waiting for me downstairs. She came with me to keep watch while I brought the money. I shouldn't be seen up here." Felicia sighs and stands to get a closer look at the box Franca had set on the kitchen table. "What's that?" she asks. With her 4th birthday approaching, she's been begging her mother for a new dress. It occurs to her that perhaps Franca has brought her one. It's shoes. Thought it best to look like I'd come with a delivery, in case anyone asked why I was here, Franca says. Oh. Felicia's eyes are level with the box. She stands on her toes to peek under the lid, wondering what a new pair of shoes might look like, smell like. But the Oxfords inside are scuffy and worn. Is there anything you need? Franca asks, pulling an envelope from inside her shirt. Felicia looks at the floor. There's a lot she needs. She doesn't answer. Franca tucks the envelope into the usual spot, behind a picture frame over the stove. Where is Mr.? What's the fellow's name? She asks, checking her watch. Felicia is about to explain that Carl hasn't yet ventured from his room when someone knocks hard on the door. Felicia's first thought is that it must be Franca's friend Sabine, but Franca jumps. She looks at her watch and then at Felicia. They stare at one another, unsure of what to do. After another knock, Franca lifts the tablecloth and points. "Hide quickly," she whispers. Felicia scrambles beneath the table. There is a third knock. This time, it sounds like metal smacking wood. "They're going to break the door down," Felicia realizes, "if no one answers it." Franca adjusts the tablecloth so it hangs a centimeter from the floor. "Coming," she calls, and then squats and whispers through the tablecloth. "If they find you, you are the daughter of the concierge." "I'm the daughter of the concierge." These are the words she's supposed to recite should someone discover her in hiding. In the months since she moved to the apartment, she hasn't needed to use them. Until today, no one but the landlord has come unannounced. "I'm the daughter of the concierge," she whispers, feeling out the lie. As soon as Franca reaches the door, Felicia hears voices. 3, 4 maybe. Yelling in a language she has learned to recognize as German. The voices belong to men. They stomp from the foyer into the kitchen. Beneath the table, Felicia startles at the jarring clatter of her bowls scattering across the floor. Amid the chaos, Franca's voice is there too, talking quickly. "She doesn't live here," she explains, then something about the shoes. But the Germans don't seem interested. "Halt die Schnauze!" one of them barks, and Felicia holds her breath as they retreat down the hallway toward the bedrooms. For a moment, it's quiet. Felicia is tempted to run or to call out for Franca, but she decides instead to count. 1, 2, 3. Before she can count to 4, there's more yelling, and when she hears Carl's voice too, she shivers. Is it him they've come for? Soon, bodies are moving, boots pounding boom boom back up the hallway in her direction, and then there are people in the kitchen, more yelling, and Carl is crying as he begs, his voice pathetic, pleading. "Please don't, please, I have papers." Felicia prays for him, prays for the Germans to take his papers and leave, but it's no use. A shot is fired. Franca screams, and a moment later, the linoleum floor shakes from the weight of something heavy meeting it with a disturbing thud. Felicia claps her hands over her mouth, trying to muffle whatever tortured sound might slip from her. Her heart beats so hard and fast, it feels as if at any moment it will bolt right up and out of her throat. One of the intruders laughs. Felicia tries to steady her breath, her body quaking from the effort. There is rustling. More laughter. Something about Zloty. "You see?" a voice croaks in broken Polish, presumably to Franca. "You see what happens once they try to hide? You tell who owns this place. We will be back." Something moves in Felicia's periphery. A ribbon of crimson, snaking slowly toward her beneath the tablecloth. She nearly vomits when she realizes what it is. Sliding silently to the far side of the table, she pulls her knees to her chest and squeezes her eyes closed. "Yes, sir." Franca's voice is barely audible. Finally, the voices and footsteps begin to recede, and the door to the apartment clicks shut. The Germans are gone. Felicia's instinct is to move, to scramble as quickly as she can from under the table, away from the bloody scene. But she can't. She rests her head on her knees and cries. In the next moment, Franca is there, beneath the table with her, holding her balled-up frame. "It's okay," she whispers, her lips pressed up against Felicia's ear as she rocks her back and forth. "You're okay. Everything will be okay." Chapter 39. Addie. Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, January 1943. Addie's first stop upon returning to Rio de Janeiro from Minas Gerais, his job in the interior complete, is the Copacabana post office. He had prayed every night in Minas that a letter might have arrived, but his hopes are immediately eradicated as he walks in and catches Gabriela's eye. "I'm sorry, Addie," Gabriela says from behind the counter. "I was hoping to have something for you." She seems genuinely sorry to deliver the news. Addie forces a smile. "It's okay. Wishful thinking." He runs his hand through his hair. "It's nice to have you back," Gabriela calls as Addie turns to leave. "See you next week," Addie offers with stilted optimism. As he exits the post office, his chin drops and his chest begins to ache. He's been a fool to hope. He sniffs, fighting tears, then squares his shoulders. "Nothing good will come of all this yearning," he tells himself. "You must do more. Something. Anything." This afternoon, he decides, he'll visit the library. He'll leaf through the foreign papers, search for clues. Perhaps he'll find a bit of news that will lift his spirits. What he'd read in Minas was disheartening and at times confusing. One article called Hitler's efforts to eradicate the Jews in Europe premeditated mass murder and reported an unthinkable number of deaths. Another article said that the Jewish situation had been largely exaggerated, that the Jews were not being exterminated, but simply persecuted. Addie didn't know what to believe, and he found it infuriating that what little information he was able to find was usually tucked into the middle of a periodical, as if the editors themselves weren't quite sure whether the facts were true, as if the headline, "Over 1 million dead since the war began," didn't belong on the front page. The fate of Europe's Jews, apparently, attracted little attention in Brazil. But for Addie, it was all he could think about. He slips on his sunglasses and tucks a hand instinctively into his pocket to find his mother's handkerchief, rubbing the soft white linen between his fingers until his eyes are dry. He glances at his watch. He's due to meet Eliska for lunch in 15 minutes. Eliska had come to visit Minas once while he was there, but seeing her hadn't done anything to repair what's begun to feel like a broken relationship. Eliska had grown despondent when Addie told her how preoccupied he was, how he could think of nothing but his family. "I wish I could understand what you're going through," she said, and for the first time, Addie had seen her cry. "Addie, what if you never find your family? What then? How will you manage?" Addie had hated hearing those words and what they implied, had resented her for saying them, even though they were the same questions he asked of himself. "I'll have you," Addie had said softly, but his words fell flat. It was obvious now. Eliska knew as well as he did that as long as his family was missing, he would never be able to commit himself fully to building a life with her, to put his whole heart into loving her. Alishka's tears weren't for him, Addie realized. They were for herself. She'd already begun to envision a future without him. At the end of the block, Addie approaches the outdoor tables at Café Campagna. He's early. Alishka isn't there yet. He takes a seat at an open table, wondering if the conversation that is about to ensue will lead to a called-off engagement, and if so, what that would mean for the two of them. Heavy-hearted, he pulls his leather notebook from his breast pocket. It's been months since he put notes to paper, but all the thoughts of his family and Eliska and what it meant to love and be loved, have churned up a melody. He sketches a staff across the blank page before him and adds the familiar three-quarters time signature. This new piece, he decides, as the first notes spill onto the paper, will be a slow waltz in a minor key. Chapter 40. Mila. Warsaw, German-occupied Poland, January 1943. Edgar, who turned 5 the week before, skips beside Mila as she walks. His nose is running and pink from the cold. "This is not the way to the park, Frau Kremski," he says it like he's smarter than she. "I know. We're making a stop on the way. It will only take a moment." Having spent the past 4 months in Warsaw working for a family of Nazis, Mila has become fluent in German. In the Becker home, which Mila learned had belonged to a family of Jews who now, she presumed, lived in the Warsaw ghetto, Mila is known as Isa Kremski. Edgar's father is a high-ranking officer in the Gestapo. His mother, Gundula, is as lazy as the house cat, but what she lacks in productivity, she makes up for in a hot temper and a raging sense of entitlement, and know-it-all with a propensity for slamming doors and squandering her husband's money. Mila's work is far from ideal, but it pays. And despite the fact that her heart breaks every day to be around a child that is not her own, she likes Edgar, as spoiled as he is. And the job is far better than her old one at the workshop in Wałowa. At least here in Warsaw, unlike in the ghetto, she has a small semblance of autonomy. Mila spends her mornings wiping furniture with a damp cloth, scrubbing porcelain bathroom tiles, and preparing meals. In the afternoons, she takes Edgar to the park. No matter the weather, frost or rain, sleet or snow, Gundula insists that her son spend an hour outside. And so every day, Mila and the boy walk the same route from the Bekel's doorstep along Stepinska Street to the southern tip of Wazienki Park. Today, though, Mila has deviated a few blocks west to a street called Zbierska. It is a risk. She isn't sure yet how she'll convince Edgar to keep quiet about the detour. But Edith had told her to come during the day, and she desperately needs to see her. Mila met Edith, a seamstress, soon after taking the job with the Beckers. Edith visits the apartment weekly to sew a tablecloth or tailor a dress for Frau Becker, a jacket for Herr Becker, a pair of knickers for Edgar. Yesterday, when Gundula was out, Edith arrived as Mila was midway through polishing a drawer full of silver, and the pair struck up a conversation. They got on beautifully, speaking in hushed tones in their native Polish. Mila couldn't help but suspect that Edith was also a Jew, posing as an Aryan. A hunch that was confirmed when Edith mentioned casually that she grew up just east of Okopowa Street, an area Mila recognized immediately as the Jewish quarter, now part of the city's ghetto. When Mila told her about Felicia, Edith mentioned a Catholic convent outside of town that might be accepting orphan children. "I could find out if there is room for one more," she offered. But just as she said it, Gundula returned, and the women worked the rest of the afternoon in silence. Before she left that day, Edith slipped Mila her address, scrawled across a corner torn from one of the Becker's periodicals. "I live just up the street," she whispered, and then added, "You'll need to visit in the early afternoon when my neighbors are at work. They are watchful." Mila glances down at the small triangular piece of paper in her palm, checks the address. For Zbierska. "What kind of stop?" Edgar wants to know. "I want to go to the park." "Your mother asked me to pay a visit to Edith, the seamstress," Mila lies. "You know her. You've seen her around the house. She measured you last week for a shirt." "What for?" "Never mind, it will only take a second." Mila rings the button next to Edith's name, grateful that the seamstress had included a surname on the address, and after a moment, Edith's voice chirps through a speaker. "Who is there?" she asks in Polish. Mila clears her throat. "Edith, it's Iza. I have Edgar with me. Please, could we come up for a moment?" A second later, the door buzzes, and Mila and Edgar climb a narrow stairway three floors to a door marked 3B. Edith greets her with a smile. "Hello, Isa. Edgar, please, come in." Edgar scowls as they step inside. "I'm sorry to barge in on you unexpectedly," Mila says. She glances at Edgar, wondering how much Polish he can understand, and looks back up at Edith. "You mentioned a convent yesterday." Edith nods in understanding. "Yes, it's in a town called Wolfsławek, about 80 kilometers from here. I sent a letter today, actually, to let them know there's a child in need. I'll tell you as soon as I hear back." "Thank you, Mila breathes. I very much appreciate the help." "Of course." Edgar tugs on Mila's skirt. "Can we go? It's been a minute." "Yes, we can go. We're off to the park," Mila adds, reverting to German as she turns to leave, trying to retain a semblance of levity in her voice. "Thanks for the visit, Isa," Edith offers. "Stay warm out there." "We'll try." The moment she hangs her coat on the rack in the Becker's foyer the following day, Mila senses something is wrong. The apartment is stagnant, eerily quiet. Herr Becker would be at work by now, but on most days, Mila arrives to Gundula puttering about, scribbling a list of chores, and to Edgar bouncing a ball or darting through the house engaged in some sort of imaginary battle, yelling, "Pow, pow, pow!" His hands cocked like imaginary pistols. Today, though, the silence in the apartment sends a cold trickling through Mila's veins. She shivers as she makes her way down a corridor to the living room. It's empty. She continues on toward the kitchen, but stops short as she passes the dining room. There is a figure at the far end of the room, sitting motionless at the head of the table. Even from the hallway, Mila can see that Gundula is red in the cheeks, her eyes ablaze with anger. Fighting the instinct to leave as quickly as she'd come, Mila turns to face her, but remains in the doorway. "Frau Becker? Is everything all right?" she asks, her hands clasped together at her waist. Gundula glares at her for a moment. When she speaks, her lips barely move. "No, Isa. Everything is not all right. Edgar told me you went to the seamstress's house yesterday on the way to the park." Mila's breath catches. "Yes, we did. I apologize. I should have told you." "Yes, you should have told me." Gundula's voice is suddenly louder and more stern than Mila has heard it before. "What, pray tell, would prompt such a visit?" Mila had guessed that Edgar might say something and had constructed an excuse in her mind. "I asked her she would come to my home later this week," Mila begins, "as I'm in dire need of a new skirt. I was embarrassed to tell you," Mila looks down. "I've been wearing this one for years as I can't afford to buy a new one." Edith mentioned one day that she had some extra fabric she could sell for a fraction of what it would cost in a store. Gundula glowers at Mila, shaking her head slowly left to right. "A skirt?" "Yes, madame. Where is this skirt?" "She's cutting it for me as we speak. Said she would bring it next week."
"I don't believe you."
What composure Gundula held a minute ago has begun to unravel.
"Excuse me? You lie. I can see it in your eyes. You lie about the skirt, about your name, about everything."
Edgar's face pokes through a doorway behind Gundula.
"Mutter? What?"
"Told you to stay in your room," Gundula snaps. "Go!"
Edgar disappears, and Gundula's chair scrapes loudly against the wooden floor behind her as she stands.
"You take me for a fool, Isa. Is that even your name? Is it?"
Mila lets her hands fall to her sides.
"Of course it's my name, madame. And of course you are right to be angry about one thing, and that is the fact that I didn't tell you about our visit to the seamstress. For that I am truly sorry, but you are wrong to accuse me of lying about my identity. I'm offended you would say such a thing."
As Gundula approaches, Mila notices a vein protruding like a purple snake from her neck and takes a step back, her instinct begging her once again to turn and run, to get out. But she holds her ground. Running would only admit the truth. Gundula is close enough for Mila to smell her breath when she stops, balls up her hands into fists, and exhales exasperated.
It sounds like a growl. I told Karti, she spits. I told him you couldn't be trusted. Just wait until he has you arrested. Just wait.
Mila backs up slowly into the corridor.
Madame, she says calmly, you are overreacting. Perhaps a glass of water would help. I will fetch you one.
As she turns to make her way to the kitchen, Mila catches something alarming in her periphery. The shadow of an object moving rapidly overhead. She ducks, but it's too late. The vase hits the back of her skull with a hollowed knock of two heavy objects colliding. At her feet, glass shatters. Mila's world goes dark for a moment. The pain is searing. With her eyes closed, she reaches for the doorway, grateful when her fingers find it, catching herself. When she opens her eyes, she touches the back of her head with her free hand. A lump has formed on the spot where the vase struck her. She glances at her fingers. Amazingly, there is no blood, just pain.
You should have run. Oh my God! Oh my God!
Gundula is crying.
Are you all right? Ach, mein Gott!
Regaining her balance, Mila steps gingerly from the mound of the broken glass at her feet and makes her way down the hallway to a closet to retrieve a broom. When she returns, Gundula is standing in the place where she left her, shaking her head, her eyes wild, like those of a crazed woman.
I didn't mean to. I'm sorry, she whimpers.
Mila doesn't reply. Instead, she sweeps. Gundula lowers herself to sit in a dining chair, muttering to herself. When her dustpan is full, Mila carries it to the kitchen, empties the glass into a trash receptacle under the sink, and returns the dustpan to the closet. Reaching for the two empty milk jars on the counter, she holds one in each hand and retraces her steps, trying desperately to ignore the throb radiating from the back of her head to her eye sockets. The voice inside pleading with her to get out, and to get out fast.
I'm going to the dairy, she says,
her voice calm as she passes the doorway to the dining room, and as quietly as she'd come, she leaves, without any intention of returning. Chapter 41 Bella Warsaw, German-occupied Poland, January 1943. They are a mother and daughter, Berla realizes from behind the shop register as she studies the two German women perusing dresses. They have the same ivory skin and sharp curve to their jaws, the same way of carrying themselves, tilting their heads just so as they run their fingers along the dresses hanging in rows throughout the shop. Bella blinks away the tears filling her eyes.
This one would look nice on you, the girl says, holding a blue wool dress up to her mother's torso. The color is just right for you. It complements your eyes.
Bella and Jakub have been in Warsaw for 6 months. They thought for a moment about staying in Radom, but Radom was a small town compared with Warsaw, and they feared they would be recognized. There was no work to be had anyway. Both ghettos had been liquidated, and only a few young workers remained. And Bella's parents, of course, were gone. They'd been deported with the others, as Reuben had warned, and it was no secret anymore. If you were sent to Treblinka, you didn't come back. And so, with no more guards manning the ghetto gates, Bella and Jakub had gathered up the few belongings that they could salvage from their empty flats, prayed that their IDs would serve them, and boarded a train to Warsaw, using all but a few of those zloty they'd stashed away for the fair. At first, Bella had hoped that the change of scenery in Warsaw might help her shed some of her grief, but it seemed that everywhere she went, everywhere she looked, there were reminders. Three sisters playing in the park, a father helping his little girl into a wagon, the mother-daughter pairs who frequented the shop where she worked. It was torture. For weeks, Bella couldn't sleep. She couldn't think. She couldn't eat. Not that there was much to eat in the first place, but she found the thought of food repulsive and refused it. Her cheekbones grew more pronounced, and under her shirt, her ribs jutted from beneath her skin like a keyboard made up of only sharps and flats.
It felt as if she were treading water with weights strapped to her wrists, as if at any moment she might drown. She was heartsick and hated the way Jakob asked her constantly if she was all right, the way he was always trying to coax a bit of food into her mouth. "Come back to me, love," he would plead. "You seem so far away." But she couldn't. The only time she felt a semblance of her old self was when they made love. But even then the feeling didn't last. The touch of his skin against hers reminded her that she was alive, and the guilt that consumed her afterward was so powerful, it made her sick. Bella knew during those first few weeks in Warsaw that she couldn't live much longer chin-deep in a sea of sorrow. She wanted badly to feel herself again, to be a better person, a better wife, to accept what had happened, to move on. But losing her sister and then her parents, it was crippling. Their deaths gnawed her in her waking hours and haunted her in her sleep. Every night, she would see her sister being dragged into the woods. She would see her parents boarding the trains that would deliver them to their deaths. Every night she dreamed of ways she could have helped them. In November, she began pinning the waistline of her skirt to keep it from falling from her hips. It was then that she realized she was in trouble, that Jakob was right. She needed to eat, to take care of herself. She needed him. She wondered, though, if it were too late. They'd been living apart for months. Jakob had said they were safer, their forged IDs more believable that way. But Bella knew there was a part of him that couldn't stand by, futile, watching her deteriorate. How could she blame him? She'd been mourning so deeply, she'd forgotten what it meant to love the man who, before her world came crashing down, was her everything. She vowed to try to pull herself together. "We'll take it," the mother says, laying the dress over the counter. Bella takes a deep breath, willing away her tears. "Of course," she says. Her German is now perfect. "It's a nice choice." She musters a smile. "Don't let her see that you are upset." She hands the woman her change. As the pair leaves, Bella closes her eyes, drained from the effort of keeping her composure. There will always be reminders, she thinks. There will be days that are not so bad, and others that are unbearable. What matters, she tells herself, is that even on the hardest days, when the grief is so heavy she can barely breathe, she must carry on. She must get up, get dressed, and go to work. She will take each day as it comes. She will keep moving. Chapter 42. Mila and Felicia. Warsaw, German-occupied Poland, February 1943. When her mother told her she had finally found a safe place for her to live, a convent, she called it, Felicia was dubious. "You will have children around you," Mila said, trying to cheer her up. "Girls of all ages, and a nice group of nuns who will care for you. You won't have to be alone anymore." Though Felicia was desperate for company, it was her mother's companionship she craved. She hated the fact that Mila would once again be leaving her. "Will the others be like me?" she'd asked, wondering if, in fact, any of the girls in this place her mother spoke of would actually want to be her friend. They were Catholics, Mila said, explaining that while she was there, Felicia would be Catholic too. Surely the other girls would want to be her friends. "Just do as the nuns say, love," she added, "and I promise they will take good care of you." On her first day at the convent, Felicia's cinnamon-red hair is dyed blonde. She is no longer Felicia Keiler. She is Barbara Cedransk. She is taught how to cross herself and to take communion. A week into her stay, when one of the nuns notices her mouthing the words to her prayers, she drags Felicia into the office of the Mother Superior and questions her upbringing. Felicia is surprised to hear the conviction in the Mother Superior's voice as she snaps, "I've known this child's family for a long time. We treat her like the rest." In fact, malnourished as she is, Felicia is treated slightly better than the rest.
The mother superior often sneaks Felicia a bite of cake when the others aren't watching, allows her a few extra minutes each day outdoors in the sun, and keeps a close watch during the children's free time, intervening when the older girls, who've deemed the skinny newcomer the runt of the group, hurl insults or sticks. Pulling her wool cap low over her brow, Mila strolls along the split-rail wooden fence of the convent's garden, trying to make out the faces of the children playing inside. She's allowed one visit per week, but this one is unscheduled. She can't help it. She hates being apart from her daughter. She scans the garden, trying to decipher which of the small bundled bodies is Felicia's. The children look alike in their dark winter coats and hats. They run and shout, their breath puffing in fleeting clouds from pink-lipped mouths as they play. Mila smiles. There's something about the sound of their laughter that fills her momentarily with hope. Finally, she notices a girl, slighter than the rest, standing still, staring in her direction. Mila makes her way casually toward the fence, fighting the urge to wave, to jump the wooden beams, to gather her daughter up in her arms and sneak her back to Warsaw. Felicia approaches the fence too, her chin cocked, curious as to why her mother has come. She keeps close track and must realize it's too soon for her next scheduled visit. Mila smiles and nods gently. There's no reason to worry, she says with her eyes. Felicia nods too in understanding. A stone's throw from her mother, she stops beside a bench, props her foot on it, and bends over, as if tying her shoelace. Upside down, her hat falls off, and her bleached blonde hair spills toward the earth, haloing her small, freckled face. She peers between her legs at her mother, and knowing the others can't see, waves. I love you, Mila mouths, and blows a kiss. Felicia smiles and returns the kiss. I love you too. Mila watches, blinking back tears, as Felicia stands, adjusts her hat on her head, and trots back to the other children. Chapter 43. Genek. Tel Aviv, Palestine. February 1943. Genek's stomach pains are back. When they come, typically every 30 minutes or so at their worst, he doubles over, grimacing. What does it feel like, Herta asked, when the pains first started, the winter before? Like someone's twisting up my intestines with a pitchfork, he said. Herta had begged him to see a doctor, but Genek was reluctant to do so. He assumed that his digestive system just needed time to readjust to a somewhat normal diet. I'll be fine, he insisted. And anyway, there were so many people in Tehran worse off than he. It was difficult to justify using up the one medic's precious time and resources. But that was in Persia. Now they're in Palestine, where, under the care of the British Army, he and his Polish colleagues in Anders' army have access to half a dozen medical tents, a host of supplies, and a team of doctors. Now, the pains are persistent and have escalated to the degree that Genek wonders if an ulcer has eaten through his stomach lining. It's time, Herta said the day before, her tone filled less with pity than with frustration. Please, Genek, go see someone before it's too late. Don't let something that could have been fixed bring you down now, after all that we've been through. He's seated at the edge of his cot, his toes grazing the ground beneath him, naked, but for a white cotton gown that opens in the back. Behind him, a doctor presses the cool, round chest piece of a stethoscope to his ribs, making hmm sounds through his nose as Genek answers each of his questions. Lie down, the doctor instructs. Genek swings his legs onto his cot and leans back, wincing as the doctor's fingers press into the pale flesh of his stomach. My guess is you've got an ulcer, he says. Stay away from citrus and anything acidic. No more oranges or lemons. Try to eat only mild foods. I have some medicine, too, to help neutralize you. Let's start there and we'll see how you're doing in a week. All right, Genek nods. The doctor adjusts his stethoscope around his neck and tucks his pen into the breast pocket of his lab coat.
I'll be back, he says. Stay put.
Genek watches him disappear. The last time he was made to wear a hospital gown was at 14, when he had his tonsils removed. He doesn't remember much of the surgery, except for the constant supply of freshly pressed apple juice he enjoyed afterward, along with a week's worth of doting from his mother. A wave of longing. What he would do right now to see his mother. It's been 3.5 years since he left home. Home. He thinks about how far he's traveled in the last 42 months. About his apartment in Lvov and the night the NKVD came pounding on his door. How he'd packed a suitcase, somehow knowing when they left that they wouldn't return. He thinks of the cattle cars to which he'd been confined for weeks on end, dark and dank and riddled with disease. And of his barracks in Siberia, and the ice-cold night Yosef was born. He thinks about all the corpses he'd seen on his exodus from Siberia to Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan to Persia. About the military camp he called home for 4 months in Tehran. And about the trip from Tehran to Tel Aviv and how, as their truck had snaked along the narrow roads of the Zagros mountain range, he contemplated the very real possibility of careening 1,500 meters to the valley floor. He thinks of Palestine's beautiful beaches, and of how much he will miss them when he's shipped off to battle. There has been much talk of late of Anders' army being sent to Europe to fight on the Italian front. His true home, of course, will always be Radom. That he knows. He crosses his ankles and closes his eyes, and in an instant, his mind has left the medical tent and arrived at a scene he knows well. A family gathering on Vorshavska Street, in the apartment where he grew up. He's in the living room, seated on a blue velvet couch beneath the portrait of his great-grandfather Gershon, for whom he was named. Herta nurses Yosef beside him. Addy is at the Steinway playing an improvised version of Cole Porter's Anything Goes. Halina and Adam dance. Mila and Ahuma chat by the walnut mantel over the fireplace, watching, laughing, as Saul twirls Felicia in the air. In the corner, Jakob stands on a chair, taking in the spectacle through the lens of his Rolleiflex. Genek would do anything to relive an evening of dinner and music at home in pre-war Radom. But as quickly as the scene in his parents' living room entered his mind, a new thought arises, another memory. His gut tightens, sending a shock of pain through his abdomen as he recalls the conversation he'd overheard as he passed by the captain's quarters earlier that week. "It has to be an exaggeration," one of the captains had said. "Over 1 million?" "Someone said 2," another voice replied. "They've liquidated hundreds of camps and ghettos." "What sick fucking bastards," the first voice replied. It was quiet for a moment, and Genek had to fight the instinct to claw his way inside, to demand more information. But he knew better. The panic in his eyes might give him away. He was supposed to be Catholic, after all. But millions? Surely they were talking about Jews. His mother, his father, his sisters and little niece. Last he knew, they were all in the ghetto. Aunts and uncles and cousins, too. He's written home 12 times but hasn't received a reply. "Please," he prays, "let the numbers be an exaggeration. Let the family be safe. Please." With a lump in his throat, Genek reminds himself that he should be grateful. He is with Herta and Yosef. They are together and for the most part in good health. Who knows how long they'll stay, but for now he is lucky to make Tel Aviv his home. The city, perched on the white sand and palm-fringed banks of the blue-green Mediterranean, is more beautiful than any he's ever seen. Even the air is pleasant, somehow smelling always of sweet oranges and oleander. Herta had summed it up in one word on the day they arrived. Paradise. The din of the medical tent filters back into Genek's consciousness, the murmur of voices, the groan of canvas stretching as his neighbor rolls to his side, the clang of a chamber pot being replaced beneath the cot. And as he comes to, something draws his attention. A voice. One he recognizes. One from a previous life. A voice that reminds him of home. His real home. He opens his eyes. Most of the patients in the tent are asleep or reading. A few talk quietly with doctors beside them. Genek scans the room, listening intently. The voice is gone. He's imagined it. Part of him is still stuck in his memory of Radham. But then he hears it again, and this time he sits up. There, he realizes, looking over his shoulder, it's coming from a doctor standing with his back to him, three beds down. Genek swings his legs over his cot, intrigued. The doctor is a head shorter than Genek, with stick-straight posture and dark hair shorn close to his scalp. Genek stares until finally he turns, peering through perfectly round eyeglasses as he scribbles something on his clipboard. Genek recognizes him immediately. His heart vaults into his throat as he stands. "Hey!" Genek yells. The two dozen men, half a dozen doctors, and handful of nurses in the tent stop what they're doing for a moment to look in Genek's direction. He yells again. "Hey! Selim!" The doctor looks up from his clipboard, surveying the room until finally his gaze lands on Genek. He blinks, shakes his head. "Genek?" Genek leaps from his cot, oblivious to his half-exposed backside, and rushes toward his brother-in-law. "Selim!" "What?" Selim staggers. "What are you doing here?" Genek, too overcome to speak, wraps his arms around Selim's torso, nearly lifting him from the floor in his embrace. The others in the medical tent watch for a moment, smiling. A few of the nurses to Genek's exposed rear exchange glances and suppress giggles before going back to their business. "You have no idea how happy I am to see you, brother," Genek says, shaking his head. Selim smiles. "It's really good to see you, too. You disappeared in Lvov. We thought we'd lost you. What happened?" "Wait, Selim." Genek holds him at arm's length, studying his face. "Tell me, have you heard from the family?" Seeing his brother-in-law has ignited something in Genek, a mix of hope and longing. Perhaps this is a good sign. Perhaps if Selim is alive, the others are too. Selim's shoulders drop, and Genek lets his hands fall to his sides. "I was going to ask you the same," Selim says. "They shipped me off to Kazakhstan, wouldn't let me write from the camp. What letters I've sent since have gone unanswered." Genek lowers his voice so the others in the tent won't overhear. "Mine too," he says softly, deflating. "The last I heard from anyone was just before Hertha and I were arrested in Lvov. That was almost 2 years ago. Back then, Mila was in Radom living in the ghetto with my parents." "The ghetto," Selim whispers. His face has gone white. "It's hard to imagine, I know. They've been liquidating the ghettos, have you heard?" "I've heard," Genek says. The men are quiet for a moment. "I keep telling myself over and over they're fine," Genek adds, looking up to the tent's rafters as if searching for answers. "But I wish I knew for sure." He lowers his eyes to meet Selim's. "It's terrible not knowing." Selim nods. "I think about Felicia often," Genek says, realizing he hasn't told his brother-in-law yet about Yusuf. "She must be 3 now?" 4. Selim's voice is distant. "Selim," Genek starts. He pauses, licks his lips, embarrassed at his riches when, for all either of them knows, Selim might have lost everyone. "Hertha and I have a son. He was born in Siberia. He'll be 1 year old in March." Selim looks pleased. He smiles. "Mazel tov, brother," he says. "What's his name?" "Yusuf. We call him Z for short." The two men stare at their feet for a while, unsure of what to say next. "What was the name of your camp in Kazakhstan?" Genek finally asks. "Dolinka. I was a medic there, and for the nearby town." Genek nods, struck by the notion that it took an internment camp, an amnesty, and an army to enable Selim to practice the profession he'd been denied in Radom.
Wish we'd had a couple of medics like you at our camp, he says, shaking his head. Where were you?
I have no idea, to be honest.
The